Welcome back to Small Town Missing. I'm Thomas.
I'm Will.
And I'm Rhonda.
And thank you guys so much for liking, commenting, subscribing, just being here. It's really appreciated, guys.
Yeah, thank y'all so much. And I just want to say, like, Rhonda, poor Rhonda has to do one of my cases again this week. So sorry, Rhonda. I know it's not as good as your scripts.
No, it's a fine script, Will, and I don't mind doing this again.
Thank you, Rhonda. You do such a good job.
Thanks, Will.
But all right, y'all ready to get into it?
Ready to just jump right in, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, today we're going to be talking about one of the most famous missing person / murder cases in United States history. And of course, if Will writes it,
it's a murder.
It's a murder.
Well, and I kind of feel bad too. We'll kind of mention, I think this one was from our old podcast, RTW's Wild History Ride, if y'all ever wanted to listen to it, I guess in another form. But I just decided, I was like, you know what? I'm going to revamp it again, just like we did with Lizzie Borden, and we'll see what goes on here.
Well, I hope everyone enjoys it.
Me too.
Okay, so obviously we're talking about the kidnapping murder of Charles Lindbergh Jr., the son of the famous aviator Charles Lindbergh.
Mm-hmm.
And first, just a little bit of history. We'll talk about Charles Lindbergh and what led to his massive stardom. Charles Augustus Lindbergh was born February 2nd, 1902 in Detroit. He actually grew up in Little Falls, Minnesota. His father had immigrated to Minnesota from Sweden in 1860, and both of Lindbergh's parents were smart and well-to-do. His father graduated from the University of Michigan Law School in 1884, and Lindbergh's mother came from a prominent family in Detroit and had obtained a degree in chemistry, which she followed up with her master's degree from Columbia University.
She's a smart lady.
Yeah, that's impressive.
I know.
That would have been, what, the late 1800s?
I know, that's pretty awesome. Shoot, I couldn't do that now. So good for her.
Yeah, I mean, a woman getting a chemistry degree, that's awesome.
Hey, that is awesome. That's awesome now. I mean, like, hey, chemistry is so hard. I remember trying to do chemistry in my, you know, rotation in college or whatever, and I'm like, I could barely do it, so bless her.
Well, I'm just kind of surprised because I didn't realize women were going into those kind of degree fields back then.
Yeah, maybe since she was, like, I'm assuming more well-to-do and something, like, maybe she had more options. But yeah, me neither, Rhonda.
Yeah, I'm impressed. The Lindberghs lived in Detroit until 1905 when their house burned down. Then they moved to Little Falls, Minnesota, where Charles's father was elected to Congress. Now, much of Lindbergh's childhood was spent in D.C. One thing that really interested Charles during his childhood was barnstorming, and he'd seen a pilot do this when he was younger.
Yeah.
And that just made him dream of becoming a pilot.
I mean, as you've seen it, I mean, if you've seen old barnstorming, you know, or any history on barnstorming, it sounds really cool. So
it does. And I assume by barnstorming, we mean what typically comes to mind is someone flies through a barn or
yeah,
they do, like, some kind of a stunt that's extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
And not to be tried at home.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Don't try this at home, what we're
exactly
saying.
Avid student, and he really liked working with mechanical things like cars, farm equipment, and motorcycles. And even when World War I came around, he was still too young to join the military, but he was actually excused from school so that he could help his family run their farm.
Mm-hmm.
His father, due to his opposition towards the war and America being involved in it, lost his seat in Congress in 1916. And as a result, the family didn't go back to D.C. as much as they had.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was a lot of opposition to World War One
yeah,
at the beginning.
I feel like I've heard about that too, even in my, like, AP history class, like, back in the day.
Yeah. Now, when Charles turned 18, his family convinced him to attend the University of Wisconsin to study mechanical engineering, which should have been right up his alley. But it didn't really stick with Charles, and he dropped out in his second year of study.
Yeah, that's hard. I mean, especially someone who didn't really like school, maybe. That's like a big undertaking to go and get your mechanical engineering degree.
I know, but with the word mechanical engineering, you'd think, oh, hands-on type
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, true.
March 1922, Charles left Minnesota and went to Nebraska to work for the Nebraska Aircraft Corporation, 1922.
Yeah.
That's 100 years ago. It was here where he got to work on planes, fix them up, and he was even able to participate in some barnstorming tours of his very own.
He did it. He did exactly what he set out to do.
Yeah. After doing this for a bit, Charles went to Georgia to purchase his very own plane, a Curtis Jenny.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what a Curtis Jenny is.
Yep. We've gone through that on the other podcast, I remember.
Yep. He worked with his plane for a year and joined the Army Air Services afterwards. Although he struggled with the scholastic aspect of flying school, Charles was one of 18 cadets that graduated the Army Flying School in San Antonio, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And after he graduated from school, he was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army and moved to St. Louis, where he became an officer in the Missouri National Guard.
He's done a lot of stuff. He's young, and I mean, he's making money moves right there, I'm telling you.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah.
He was then contracted to fly airmail between St. Louis and Chicago, which was very dangerous at the time. Mm-hmm. I can only imagine. Mm-hmm. You just have to fly that in any type of weather.
I wouldn't want to fly that now. So I mean, that was his heart for then.
True that.
He was responsible for plotting routes and training pilots, but the skill he learned here would be very important for his long-run success.
Yes.
Due to his experiences, he began toying with the idea of going on a transatlantic flight, which had never been done before. Okay, so we're looking at still in the 20s, mm-hmm. 1920s, and he was born in, let me find this again.
I forgot, it's at the very beginning.
1902.
Yes, I mean, he's young.
Yeah, he's like maybe mid-20s.
Yeah.
Okay. Charles wasn't the only pilot interested in this transatlantic flight. A French businessman named Raymond Orteig.
Yeah, I think that's right. Or Orteig. Is it one of those?
Yeah, O-R-T-E-I-G had actually offered a prize of $25,000 to anyone who could successfully fly from New York to France. $25,000.
Yeah, well, you think that, I mean, that's probably not a lot now, but I bet back in the day that was a lot of money.
I don't think anybody would turn down $25,000. Maybe nope. Not risk their lives.
Yeah, true.
Like they would back then, but yeah, that's a lot of money.
I mean, that's still not a, you know, that's a pretty good amount of money now, too, you know, speaking of. But I mean, yeah, like you're right. I don't know if I'd sacrifice my life for that.
No, but I imagine to the pilots back in the 20s, it's like, oh, yeah.
Why it's not? Like, we're in.
Yeah. Some pilots had actually lost their lives attempting this flight, but it definitely wasn't a simple task to complete.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the teams that had attempted this had strong financial backing and team support. Now, Charles himself had his experience and $2,000 in the bank.
Not much.
No, that's not. It seems kind of far-fetched for a lot of people to contemplate taking that trip with $2,000 in the bank. This changed in early 1927. As Charles received financial backing from several important St. Louis businessmen, with all this help, Charles created his legendary plane, the Spirit of St. Louis.
Y'all have heard of that one before a couple times.
Yes. Charles worked on the plane to make it lighter and able to hold more fuel. I believe it was built in California.
I think that's right.
Charles started his trip on May 20th, 1927, and eventually landed in Paris, May 21st, 1927, where he's welcomed as a hero and instantly became a global superstar.
Yeah, as you would. I mean, that's a big deal.
Yeah, he basically became an overnight success and celebrity. He became wealthy from the prize money and securing a well-paid positions with Transcontinental Air Transport and Pan American Airways.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, Charles married a woman named Anne Morrow in 1929. She was the daughter of a wealthy bank executive and U.S. ambassador to Mexico. They eventually started a family together until tragedy struck in 1932.
Yes. Yeah, so like that's where like our backing kind of heads up. Because, you know, a lot of people, like, before I researched this, like, I really didn't know much about Charles Lindbergh up until, like, I was like, oh, wow. Like, he's done a lot of stuff. Like, I knew about the transatlantic flight. Like, I feel like we've heard about that in a lot of history courses. But it is cool. I mean, he's done a lot by this point. So I wanted to give kind of a little backing before we went into the actual case here.
All right. Well, now we get to the kidnapping. Occurring on March 1st, 1932, so Lindbergh would have been 30 years old.
Yeah, would have been 30, but so, young, very young.
Yeah, the whole world watched and waited as Charles Lindbergh Jr., a 20-month-old child, and the son, obviously, of Charles and Anne, was abducted from the family's new mansion in Hopewell, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
The kidnapping had apparently occurred around 9 p.m. on March 1st. After noticing the child was missing, Betty Gow, G-O-W, the nurse for the Lindbergh family reported her findings to the family at approximately 10 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
An immediate search of the scene turned up a ransom note which demanded $50,000 for the child's safe return.
That's a lot. I mean, I will say, I mean, I know it doesn't seem like, I guess, but like what, 1932?
Yeah, this is like height of the Depression.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money. And it's interesting because I wonder just how wealthy Charles Lindbergh was.
Yeah, I wonder how much he would have, like, liquid assets or something he would have had maybe to, like, give that, like, if he would have had it. I'm sure he would have, but that's still a ton of money.
Mm-hmm. The note was left on the nursery windowsill. Eventually, the police were notified and an investigation was started. During the initial phases of the investigation, traces of muddy footprints were found on the nursery floor. But officials were unable to make measurements of the prints.
I don't know why. That's weird.
Well, you know, it's not like these days where you kind of safeguard the scene.
Yeah.
I'm sure there were all kinds of people walking in and out.
Yeah.
I mean, even before the police were called, mm-hmm. I'm sure.
Well, we already know, kind of, I guess, like the nurse had been in there and, you know, no telling what she would have disturbed, not meaning to, but like investigating, like, oh, where's the kid? You know, I'm sure that was scary. So I don't blame her for going all over the room searching if she did that, you know.
Yeah. And of course, the baby's parents would have come in. Everybody would have been in there, I'm sure. So it's, like I said, it's not how we view crime scenes these days.
Yeah, so we had to look at it through a lens like that.
Yeah. A broken ladder was found outside the nursery window, and it appeared as if the ladder was how the perpetrator had gained entrance into the house. Police suspected that the ladder had been broken as the kidnappers escaped from the home. No other physical evidence was apparently discovered during this time.
Yeah, that's sad, too. And I wonder if, like you said, Rhonda, any of the going around the scene would have tampered with anything, potentially. You know, who knows?
Possibly.
Yeah. You can never outlaw that. So,
during this time, Charles and his family made many appeals to the kidnappers for the safe return of Charles Jr. According to CharlesLindbergh.com, various underworld characters were dealt with in attempts to contact the kidnappers, and numerous clues were advanced and exhausted during this time as well.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Eventually, a second ransom note was written and delivered to the Lindberghs on March 6, 1932. So this was, I'm flipping back to the notes.
No, that's fine. I feel like it was just a couple days after, maybe?
5 days.
Yeah, 5 days.
Because mm-hmm. he was taken on March 1st that night.
Mm-hmm.
The demand for Charles Jr.'s return was increased to $70,000.
Y'all, I'm telling you, like, they're just keeping on going up.
That is a lot of money.
That is.
I like I said, 1932 is the height of the Depression.
Yeah.
What, like a quarter of the country was unemployed?
I need to look that up, Rhonda. Maybe I'll look that up as you go along. I'll let you know how much 70,000 was in what, 1932?
I'll look it up.
Oh, Thomas is looking it up. Thanks.
All right. Police conference was then convened with many police officers, government representatives, in an attempt to discuss various theories and policies of procedures towards the case.
Yeah, just to see how they would proceed.
Over the course of the next couple of months, 13 separate ransom notes would be delivered to the Lindberghs. 13.
Yeah. I didn't realize that. When I did my first look into this, it was like, oh, yeah, and then there was another one delivered, and then another. And I'm like, I don't really know what all those entailed, but at the same time, I'm just like, please tell me where, like, I can just drop off this money so I can get this child back. Like, are you kidding? Like, 13's a lot.
Yeah, so there's a total of, like, okay, so that was 13.
Yeah, 13 total. Sorry, okay. I kind of worded that. It was 13 total.
Still, that's a lot of ransom notes.
All right. Oh, and Thomas, what you got?
Okay, so 70,000 in 1932, you said?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Would be the equivalent of $1.5
million. Oh, wow.
That is a lot of money.
That's a lot. I don't know. You think Charles would have had something like that?
He might have. I don't know.
If he didn't, I imagine he had ways to get
it. Oh, I'm sure he did. Yeah.
During this time, go-between was named Dr. John F. Condon, C-O-N-D-O-N, a retired school principal, became the liaison between the Lindbergh family and the kidnappers.
Mm-hmm.
All right. During a couple of occasions, Dr. Condon met with an unidentified man that referred to himself as, quote, John. This individual eventually agreed to supply a token of identity to Dr. Condon. Sorry, I'm tripping all over my words.
Hey, you're fine, Rhonda.
In the form of a baby sleeping suit, which was apparently identified as belonging to Charles Jr. by the Lindberghs themselves.
Yeah, so apparently, like, he was able to produce, like, something that Charles would have theoretically, like, worn.
Okay, any idea where this doctor came from? Was he, like, a family friend,
I don't know if he was a family friend. I think what I saw in the notes was that he ended up like wanted to put up some of like his own money to like help find the kid or something like that. And then somehow inserted himself into the case. And it was somehow agreed in between the Lindberghs and the kidnappers that, okay, we'll use this guy who's not like very much affiliated with either side as like our go-between. So somehow he inserted himself into this case and just somehow was approved as the go-between guy.
Okay. So he had no real relationship with the Lindberghs to that point.
As far as I know, I don't believe he did.
Okay. I was just curious about that. On March 29th, 1932, Betty Gow, the nurse for the Lindberghs, discovered an infant's thumb guard near the entrance of the Lindbergh estate. This was supposedly worn by Charles Jr. during the time of his napping. Just a few days later, another ransom note was received that instructed the family to have the ransom money ready by April 2nd, 1932.
Yeah, I'm like, this is a, what, a month almost after his kidnapping and stuff. Like, gosh, like, please let us give this money away.
You know? It was exactly a month because he disappeared the evening of March 1st.
Martin. Mm-hmm.
Eventually, Dr. Condon met with John at St. Raymond Cemetery in the Bronx and delivered the expected amount of the ransom. He was then given a receipt, that's interesting, and a 13th note, which actually contained instructions for retrieving Charles Jr. According to the note, Charles Jr. would be found on a boat named Nellie near Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
A search of the supposed area of recovery was performed, but Charles Jr. wasn't found.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, does that mean they found the boat?
So I don't know if they even found the boat, honestly. Like, I don't think they were able to really uncover anything. If they did find the boat, I mean, they obviously didn't find Charles. So, I mean, it's assumed, I guess, that, like, this was all fake information.
Okay,
like, gotcha. Maybe someone taking advantage or, like, you know, just trying to get the ransom money.
Unfortunately, the body of Charles Jr. was eventually discovered on May 12, 1932. The body was partially buried and badly decomposed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would assume so. Officials thought the body had been there for a couple of months, or essentially the entire for the entirety of the ransom demands from the kidnappers.
Yeah, so this whole 2 months while they're going back and forth with these like kidnappers, he's been dead this whole time.
It was suspected that the cause of death was from a blow to the head. Some even speculated that this blow to the head could have been sustained from dropping the child onto the ladder during the night of the kidnapping.
Yeah, which could explain why the ladder may have been broken or something like that.
Yeah, see, what I was thinking is maybe they were coming down the ladder broke, and whoever was carrying the child and the child both fell.
Yeah, both fell, and then maybe he just sustained like some kind of injury there or something like that. So, which y'all have heard that before, right? Like that was the theory that the ladder might have played some kind of, you know, been like what potentially like killed Charles Lindbergh Jr. You've heard that before?
I have. The fall.
Yeah.
Either the kidnapper fell on the baby, or maybe when they fell, the baby hit something on the ground or hit the ladder itself.
Yeah.
The broken ladder. As they fell.
This wasn't a professionally like made ladder. It's pretty rickety, it looks like.
Oh, it was a rickety?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, it's a terribly bad looking ladder. I've seen pictures of it. It looks like scrap pieces just put together.
Yeah, and you'll kind of find out why, or a little bit about the ladder in a little bit, too. So.
Okay. Following Charles Jr.'s murder, then-President Herbert Hoover authorized the FBI to serve as, quote, the primary federal agency on the case. In an attempt to locate the kidnappers, serial numbers for the bills paid to John were released in an attempt to eventually locate the kidnappers.
Yeah, so maybe they could be like, oh, okay, we found this bill. Who gave it to us? We'll, like, find them out.
Due to an executive order released April 5th, 1933, all gold certificates were to be exchanged before Federal Reserve notes. This would cause a major break in the case because the ransom was paid in gold certificates.
Yeah, only. So, like, that way they could be like, oh, okay, so if there's any circulating gold certificates from this ransom, which I'm sure this person's not willing to just, like, give up all at the same time, then we'll be able to find out who it was.
Oh, you know, I'd never really thought about it, but I guess I had assumed that it was like a bag of money had been given to this person.
Well, and I think it was something to do. It wasn't just because of this case. Like, I think it was supposed to do with something dealing with like the Great Depression and stuff like that. But it just so happened that this kind of thing helped, you know, in this case, in this regard. So,
oh, the gold certificate.
Yeah, gold certificate. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Due to this development, a suspect emerged when a gas station attendant took down the license plate of a man who paid with a $10 gold certificate.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, police tracked down this man who is identified as Bruno Hauptmann.
Uh-huh.
Hauptmann. H-A-U-P-T-M-A-N-N.
I think you said Hauptmann. It right.
A Bronx resident and a German carpenter. Bruno also matched the description of John, one of the supposed kidnappers, according to Dr. Condon.
Yeah, so he was like, I remember Dr. Condon in the research is like, if I ever see John or something like that, or I have somebody to identify, I can identify who it was. So I think he thought that this was the guy.
So do we know if he in any way tried to disguise himself, John, whenever he met with the doctor?
I don't know. I'm surprised if he wouldn't have tried. So I don't know. I didn't see that part in my notes, but yeah, you would think he would have, like, you know, wear some kind of weird clothing or, like, a hat or, you know, something weird. I wouldn't want to look like myself, you know.
No, I don't think anyone would want to do that if they've committed some great crime.
Yeah, exactly. So, I don't know. I need to research that a little more, Rhonda.
On September 19th, 1934, which, like, 2 years later, Bruno was arrested. He was even found to have $20 gold certificates from the ransom on his person at the time of the arrest. Wow. that's pretty, a red flag.
That's pretty incriminating.
Over the course of the next few months, 13,000 in gold ransom certificates were found in Bruno's garage. Handwriting analysis was performed on the ransom notes, and it was determined that Bruno's writing was
stylistically
similar.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Great word there.
So I think that's a word. It didn't give me the little red undertone like on Word, but it's like a fake word. But yeah, I think I don't know. I feel like I've heard that handwriting is a little, I don't know, I'd like not an exact science. Like I've heard that before, I feel like, in cases.
All right, I would have to say these days it's certainly not an exact science with me because I type so much.
Yeah.
I don't write much at all anymore.
Yeah. Well, and that too, I feel like though, like people can disguise their writing a little bit too. Like, I mean, if you're willingly try to write differently or something on like, you know, these ransom notes or, you know, for instance, then I don't know. I feel like I would deliberately not write the way I write. So I don't know. Like you'll kind of see too, he alleges in a little bit some things, but I don't know. I'd take that little information with a grain of salt.
It was even found that Bruno had a prior record for burglary, which didn't exactly work out in his favor.
No, they're like, oh, this criminal, you know.
With all of the mounting evidence, Bruno was indicted for the murder of Charles Lindbergh Jr. on October 8th, 1934. During the trial, it was revealed that the ladder used to gain access to the Lindbergh home had incorporated a piece of flooring missing from Bruno's attic.
Yeah, I don't know how they would even determine that was like, I feel like a lot of places have similar flooring. So I don't know. I mean, unless it matched a piece of it. I don't know. That is a little weird, but apparently they found that. So who knows?
Oh, hey, would this be like early forensics?
See, that's what I was thinking. See, that would have been something like me and you would have been trying, Rhonda. We'd be like, oh, yeah, look at this. Like, where did he get this piece? Like, why does this ladder look so rickety? Like, what's it made of? So I'm sure it would have been. They're really trying to like cross their T's and dot their I's here.
I imagine there was a lot of pressure to make sure that this got taken care of.
Yeah, 100%, because this is like a national celebrity.
Yeah, they wanted to make sure they had the right guy.
Yep.
Besides this, it was found that Bruno had written Dr. Condon's telephone number on a closet door frame in his home.
Yeah, so like he would have been allegedly talking to Condon during that time anyway, so maybe he just had to write it, you know, during one of their conversations or something like that, so that's why it was on there. But I don't know. I can see both ways, because he always alleged like that he was innocent. Like he said that he was holding the money for a friend, and I think the friend necessarily had already passed. I forget the name, but that was all alleged. But you know, I don't know. I guess you can't disprove it necessarily.
Despite allegations from Bruno alleging police brutality against him, he was pronounced guilty on February 13th, 1935. And executed by electric chair on April 3rd, 1936.
They wasted no time. I mean, like, literally, that he went on. I feel like death row inmates or whatever, like, they always kind of are on death row for a long time.
Oh, yeah. There's all kinds of. I think if you're. If you get the death sentence, it's automatic appeal.
Yeah.
And I imagine the appeals go on for quite some time.
I could probably bet money they didn't let an appeal happen with this case, if I had to guess.
Probably not.
Okay, I do have a question. He said he alleged police brutality. What did he mean by that? Did they beat him up?
Yeah, they beat him up. So, and unless he would like do exact handwriting samples that like match the notes and stuff like that, like that's what he alleged. Like basically, like they're making me like make up this fake evidence to incriminate myself.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
So I don't know. I mean, both ways. I mean, there's really nothing. We can't really disprove or prove that. So, you know, that just is what it is.
So did he say that, like, the gold certificates were planted on him and that
he was
kind of
holding
thing?
It for this guy? I can probably look up the name. He said that he had gotten this money. He's like, oh, just hold it for me. And then apparently, like, never. Either the guy passed or, like, he never talked to him again. So he was just kind of left with all this money from this ransom. So I don't know. So I don't know. That's a little too far-fetched for me to believe.
$13,000, that is a lot of money to hold for somebody, and they don't say, and he doesn't say anything like, well, you know, if something happens to me, you need to give this to
Or
this
like
person.
Burn it or get rid of it or something like that, you know, to not, like, I don't know, y'all. Like, 13 is a lot of money, but I don't want to go to jail for something or electrocuted for something I didn't do. So I don't know. It is weird. It's just kind of like, I think that's where some of the theories come in this case sometimes, where they're like, oh, like, you know, not everything makes sense, so maybe it was something else, but I don't know. That's for another time, a different podcast.
Yep.
Well, this has certainly been interesting, Will. I'm glad you brought this back up, because I don't know that we discussed so much of the murder on RTW Wild History.
No, not really. I feel like it was a lot shorter of a conversation. It was more about the history, I think, part of Charles Lindbergh.
Yeah, I agree. It was more about the history of Lindbergh himself. Very interesting. Like I said, this is kind of like the beginnings of some forensic science.
Yeah.
The FBI being pulled into this.
Yep.
Kidnapping. I guess, I don't know if they're pulled into every kidnapping or maybe if it's only cross state lines.
I would assume they would have probably thought this was a cross state line. So I think that that's why they're like, okay, we'll go ahead and get the FBI involved too. So,
wow.
Interesting though, I'm telling you. And it's one of those infamous ones. Like I mean, I heard about, and I think we said this on RTWs, I had heard about this case on from Family Guy of all places, like back in the day. And it was more so like just mentioned in brief. And then from there, I kind of looked it up and found out like, oh, like this was a real case. And I had no idea. So.
Oh, so you'd never heard of the Lindbergh kidnapping case?
I knew who Charles Lindbergh was, but at that time, before I watched that episode, I didn't know that he had a child that was kidnapped and murdered. I'd never known that.
Very interesting. Well, I'm glad that you resurrected this and put this on our this small town missing.
Yeah. Yep, that's right.
Good deal.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for liking, commenting, and subscribing again. Please continue to share. Give us your suggestions on Instagram.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what's our Instagram, Thomas?
Small Town Miss.
All one word.
So thank you guys so much, and looking forward to the next one.
Me too.